so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 Co-op Radio CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, on unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, May the 24th, 2019. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined today here by my vegan co-host, Jen Dobell.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on the show today. Today's show is packed with content, and we have three interviews coming up for you today. For our first interview, we welcome back local animal advocate David Isbister on the show, who we've had on for the past 2 weeks to provide us with updates on the latest happenings involving the Vancouver Aquarium. In this week's update with David, we'll learn more about the recent announcement that the aquarium is now suing the City of Vancouver and the Vancouver Park Board for unknown millions, maybe, of quote-unquote lost revenue dollars since the 2017 dolphin and whale ban. Then for our next interview, we'll have local Capilano University instructor Nicholas Jennings on the show. He has designed and will be leading a new upcoming university course in the fall called Veganism and Sustainability. This innovative course will explore veganism as an urgent response to growing epidemics, environmental catastrophes, and a global shift in ethical values. For our feature and final interview, we will have Brigitte Gem in the studio to speak with us about her work as a vegan food educator and consultant for her vegan family kitchen. Brigitte comes from a past of being a self-proclaimed meat-loving carnivore who transformed 6 years ago into an enthusiastic vegan and became an expert in cooking wholesome and nutritious plant-based meals from scratch with efficiency. She now teaches these skills to individuals who just want to cook better and vegan for themselves and for their families. We will speak to Brigitte about tips and techniques on how to approach batch cooking from scratch to create healthy and delicious vegan meals. Plus, we will also learn more about what it's like to be a vegan mom raising vegan children. So please do stay tuned. And Jen, you have something to share with us.
Yes, we here at Animal Voices have created a Facebook group for pregans, as I like to call people who are not yet vegan. And you can go to our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join the 22-day vegan challenge group, where you will get assistance for going vegan beginning on June 1st. And the reason I'm starting at June 1st is just to give you a chance to finish up any groceries you may have in your fridge and you don't want them to go to waste. And so we'll also have a request for a guest on our show from this group of people that decide to take on the challenge. And what we'd like to do with that one person, or maybe even more, is have them come out to animal rights outreach events, where the regular Vancouver activist scene is regularly doing events educating the public on veganism. And what you would do is, while you're doing the 22-day challenge, come to one or a few of our events and just shadow an activist who's talking to the public about going vegan and answering all the common kind of arguments that we hear against veganism. It's a great learning opportunity. There won't be any request of you to partake, just to shadow. And then we'd like to have that person come on the show and talk about their experience doing that 22-day challenge and what they learned, and what they learned also from the outreach event. And the best part is that you get to hang out with the local vegan activists, a really great group of people who I love and proud to call my friends.
Like Jen Dobell.
Oh, thank you. And so on that show, we will also have Matthew Negra, who is a recent graduate of Boucher Institute of Naturopathic Medicine. We've had him on the show twice now, and he will also be able to answer any further questions that person had about that 22-day challenge. And even now, I've been vegan 6 years, I'm still learning things from Matthew. He's a wealth of information. So on that Facebook group, we're going to be basically providing a support system for you. We're going to be posting pictures of our meals and health information, tips for eating in local restaurants, restaurants, documentary films, YouTube speeches by well-known vegan doctors that really helped me out when I was going vegan, answering all your questions about a vegan lifestyle. And so we encourage you to go to Animal Voices Vancouver Facebook page now. The group is posted there. You can add friends if you have friends that you're looking to get into the vegan lifestyle. And the best part is the giveaway. So if you listen to last week's show, we had a local entrepreneur named Serena on. She has a few businesses, and one of them is Rub-A-Dub, which is a lot of bath and beauty products. So she'll be giving out a gift pack to every single participant who honestly does the 22-day vegan challenge. And of course, this will just be on the honor system. And so for that person that decides to go the extra step and come on the radio show and do the outreach with the activists, you get the bath and body package as well as Witty Little Vegan t-shirt. And she has amazing t-shirts as part of her other business.
That sounds like a very good incentive.
And what a great time of year to be getting into veganism. All kinds of nice healthy foods are in season, and the activists are out almost every weekend, so there's a lot of fun things to take part in, and not just activism related. We also have a group of vegans that go to Kitsilano Beach about twice a week.
Yeah, and they hang out and they have fun. Yeah. But we have other, I know you partake in other events as well. People go out to dinner and we go dive into Deep Cove.
Yeah, we're kind of addicted to fun. It's a good group. And when you go vegan, you do find that you need that support system. So that's sort of part of the incentive as well.
Well, thank you for that. And we will have that group posted. I think you did post it on our Facebook page already.
It's on there now.
Okay, so you can take a look at that on our Facebook, Animal Voices Vancouver, or just look for the group itself. So, Jen, what's been happening in the last week at the aquarium?
Well, for those who tuned in last week, we had David Isbister on right after he spoke with the new CEO of the Vancouver Aquarium. And that meeting left most of us cautiously optimistic. And then the next day, the Vancouver Aquarium announced that they are suing the city and the park board over the 2017 cetacean ban for breach of contract and claiming it lost millions of dollars in revenue. And so in May 2017, the park boards voted 6-1 to approve a bylaw banning whales, dolphins, and porpoises in captivity. Of course, the ones that are already there were grandfathered in. And the bylaw went into effect immediately, preventing the Vancouver Aquarium from bringing new cetaceans into the Stanley Park. And in a civil claim filed May 14th, the Vancouver Aquarium states attendance has dropped in the last 2 years, adding that the bylaw has interfered with the aquarium's ability to carry out day-to-day administration of the Marine Science Center. I'm not sure how the Marine Mammal Rescue Center could have been affected, by the way. They rescue mainly pinnipeds, and a couple of times I think they've rescued cetaceans, and if they are to rescue a cetacean in the future, they do have options on where that cetacean can go besides display tanks for public entertainment. So I reached out to local activist David Isbister again this week just to find out what he thought about this announcement right on the heels of what he kind of felt was a mildly successful meeting with the new CEO. So let's hear what David had to say about the lawsuit being announced.
Well, it's a little bit strange, I suppose. I was sort of casually optimistic or cautiously optimistic after the meeting, and I think I still have a tiny little bit of that left. I don't really know all the details of Mr. Gustafson's involvement with the lawsuit or not, or what his thoughts are on it, and he still has some recommendations to make to the board on June 20th, so I'll retain a little bit of optimism, but I have to say it did feel like old times anyway.
Old times, and for our audience members that might not know what you mean by that, of course I do. Do you want to just elaborate?
It felt like dealing with Mr. Nightingale, perhaps, or the spirit of...
Yeah, I know what you mean. I was feeling the same way. And again, I remember saying when I spoke with you about that meeting that I was cautiously optimistic. I mean, we do want to be hopeful, and we do easily get excited that there's going to be change. But at the same time, we know that money rules that place, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's historically what's happened. And I think this lawsuit's a great example of there being sort of, no offense to crybabies, but a little over the top to try and take this money out of potentially taxpayer coffers just really shows where their focus is directed, and that is money.
And I don't even think that this could be a successful lawsuit, because how does one prove that a decline in attendance is directly related to a new bylaw? I mean, maybe people are just...
Well, and not related to blackfish, and not related to SeaWorld's perception, and not related to their past history, and not related to two whales dying, and not related to two more dying in the same year. It's preposterous, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, potentially people are just waking up to the fact that it's cruel, and the Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered documentary, I know, resulted in a lot of people seeing things through a different light. This is the kind of stuff that nobody really knew about until it was exposed.
Yeah, speaking of other lawsuits that the aquarium loses,
Right. So anyway, I recall at a park board meeting in 2017, the aquarium's then CEO, John Nightingale, was asked if he would respect the park board bylaws. You were there for that meeting. What was his reply?
He paused and smirked, and then he said, "The short answer is yes."
I always found him a little bit cocky.
Oh, yeah? Sure is, yeah.
And so you did just meet with the new CEO of the aquarium last week, and you did mention that you were feeling cautiously optimistic, as I was. Now, the next day, that news came out about the lawsuit, and I think that took everybody by surprise after we heard about that meeting and we were getting a little bit excited that there would be a change there. How did that leave you feeling about the meeting? Did you kind of look back on what he said as being maybe just getting us off his backs for a while by saying things that would please us, or do you think he was being genuine?
Well, he didn't get us off his back for a while. We went right back with only a day and a half notice and had a little get together outside there. So, and that went well. I think if I'm just sort of stitching the timeline together, you know, he has a bunch of recommendations to make to the board on June 20th. It might be that things that were already moving couldn't be adjusted. So I'm hoping, and that's not to enable any of this, honestly, a bunch of BS that they're doing with this lawsuit. But maybe there are some improvements to make still, and if there aren't, then we'll still be right back there again and in his face.
Yeah, and I did love that as soon as you got that news, you just got a bunch of activists together to show up at the aquarium and let them know that if they're going to be continuing with more of the same, well, so are we, and we can make it look pretty bad for the tourists that show up there. And we are usually successful at turning away quite a few people by educating them.
Oh, we had at least 20 turnaways on the weekend. It was pouring down rain, but it was warm. People were mostly receptive. Some of the news organizations sort of missed the point of the protest a little bit, but lots of people in lineup got it, and lots of the other news outlets got it. So I think it was really successful.
Can you briefly tell me, just before we run out of time here, how those conversations go when you meet somebody at the aquarium who was gung-ho on buying a ticket? What are the perceptions that they've had, and how are you able to talk them out of those?
They always say predominantly the same thing. They say that they heard about it, you know, in their country or from their travel agent or, you know, somewhere else on the internet, that it was a rescue and they wanted to come here and see the amazing facility doing the great work that the facility does. They also talk about animals and education and their kids. And if they're locals, they tend to talk about like it being an escape. So in the lineup that day, we just asked them, do you know that the Vancouver Aquarium is suing the city of Vancouver and the park board, and that money would end up coming out of taxpayer funds? And then most of the people were pretty upset by that. The other way that we bring it up is just obviously with the cetacean numbers and the various animals and other CASA issues around self-accreditation and the history of cetacean captivity there, and that often works. It just kind of depends on what the person engages with.
Right. I remember one day that I was there protesting and an entire family came out crying at what they saw in there. They went in thinking it was a rescue center. They were actually vegans. I was surprised they even went in. And I said, well, you know, if you're this upset about it, why don't you go back to the ticket booth right now and ask for your money back because you feel deceived? And they did. And they were refused.
Yes. Yeah. We've seen a couple people successfully get refunds if they weren't in there that long or if they come out upset and the people are making a scene. In fact, it happened to a couple. Well, I forgot the gentleman's name. I think it might be Paul, but Linda, she was very affected by what we said. She cried with us outside. And then she went in for about 15 minutes just to verify because they had already had a ticket. And then they got a refund and they came back out to show us that they had got a refund. So that's really nice. I think we are able to engage people. The message is pretty simple and it's factual.
Right.
And if you don't respond, it, you're kind of choosing, you know, whether that's your intent or not, you're kind of choosing to harm animals.
Right.
So we just hope people engage with it and do the best they can with what they have in the moment.
Well, thank you so much for being on today, and I'm sure we'll speak with you again soon.
Thanks again.
Okay, take care.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
For
For our next interview today, we have Nicholas Jennings on the show. Nicholas is an instructor at our local Capilano University in North Vancouver, and he has created vegan education events at the school before. Now there will be a new 3-credit academic course elective on veganism and sustainability at CAPU that will launch this fall. This course will help students to develop essential skills to university success while studying plant-based approaches to health, ethics, and the environment. Nicholas is here today to tell us more about this upcoming initiative and how you can enroll. Hello, Nicholas, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, Allison. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to tell us about this new course that you are the designer and lecturer of. First, thank you for, just creating this course on veganism and sustainability. Can you tell us about how the implementation of this course came about?
Sure. So around May of 2018, a campus-wide call went out to faculty asking for proposals for a piloting of first-year seminar courses, which are basically electives for students to choose. They would select just one such course from each of the 5 faculties. So how it was broached was, do you have a passion or an interest that you would like to teach as an academic course? And for me, this is a clarion call, and I absolutely jumped on it. My proposal went through various drafts, and I was delighted to have it chosen. Basically, I spoke to plenty of people whose ideas it had been favored over, including actually my coordinator had put a lot of time into her own course, and that was blown out of the water. So mine was included among the initial pilot courses set to open this spring. And so I presented my course to the Senate Curriculum Review Board for my faculty, which is Education, Health, and Human Development, and it won unanimous approval. Ultimately, I had to take a leave of absence in fall of last year, and therefore mine was unable to run until fall of this year. And the wonderful thing about this is that how I run the course will be informed by the learning curve and experiences of those pioneer courses that ran in the spring. So the major takeaway from that is to scale things down somewhat, which is kind of a relief as I had initially packed a lot into my curriculum.
Well, I'd like you to discuss why veganism makes a suitable university level course. We've seen them, like here at Animal Voices, I've seen them sort of been announced from different parts of the world, but they're kind of few and far between. What are some of the most critical issues today that fall under the topics that you will be teaching about that you think that university students or young adults or really just anyone should have a sound education on?
Sure. Well, I think increasing numbers of young people are learning scary things about the world they've inhabited. For example, that animal agriculture is the single largest contributor to the devastation being inflicted on the planet. The meat and dairy industry have been deceiving people for decades, in bed with the health charities and big pharma to keep us addicted to things that sicken us. The rainforests are being chopped down solely to grow cattle feed. There's just the woeful inefficiency of it all. That the things going on behind closed doors at farms and processing plants very close to where you live every single day would, turn the entire country vegan if they cared to look at it. And, the corresponding truth of that information is that we can do something about it, not only by disrupting and boycotting those industries, but by transforming them and by taking back our health. So I also think that business-savvy students can't but take notice of how profitable the plant-based sector has proven to be.
Right.
Well,
I'm really interested to know about what this course curriculum will entail. I know that one of the major projects for the course will be having the class make a mini documentary. That's an incredible plan. That really interests me. Can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. So I unfortunately didn't manage to connect with the Ottawa International Vegan Film Festival crew when I was at the expo. I had my kids with me. I was a little distracted, although I did see the flyers, so I didn't come across their booth. But I have nonetheless reached out through their website, and I intend to follow their submission protocol. Regarding the mini documentary, I'm in touch with instructors in the film and animation department here at CAP who specializes in courses that teach mini documentary filmmaking, and I hope to liaise informally with them. One of the course requirements is a book related to the down and dirty elements of creating mini documentaries with no previous experience. And while students don't actually need any background in filming or filmmaking per se, it seems a reasonable given that there will be tech-savvy students in the class, you know, who'll be up for the challenge. And we do have camcorders available. So the documentary will bring together three threads of ethics, environment, and health, and the students will be graded according to specific rubrics. And it's really hoped that the video will be, you know, ideally it will be slickly presented, shot in multiple locations, strategic to a better understanding of these issues, and will carry its own in the competition, all the while bringing these issues to the public.
Very awesome. As the course designer, can you tell us what else makes this course unique compared to the several other post-secondary courses on similar topics that I've heard of being offered in North America mostly?
So, I mean, in addition to the documentary, one aspect of the course is that it uses instructional materials published by TED Talks geared towards achieving the gold standard of TED Talks presentation skills with which to deliver these messages in a fairly professional way on camera. And as I say, so they'll learn these presentation skills, other outreach skills with which to educate people in these topics. Leaving the course with practical skills to use in the future, educating a new generation of social justice advocates. But I think the mini documentary is really its capstone, with the additional excitement of entering a world-class competition promoting such projects.
Right. What are some just documentaries or maybe books that you can think of that have influenced you to learn all about veganism and to basically use your knowledge as a vehicle to pass it on to others?
Yeah, I mean, my background in veganism goes back several decades. I went veggie in 85 and I went vegan in 88. So the things that drove me into it then, I mean, the world has really changed since then. And certainly the documentaries there's an ongoing learning curve, right? Mm-hmm. So documentaries that have really woken me up have been things like What the Health. I mean, you know, the light that sheds on the degree of sort of connivance between industries and that sort of thing. And I think these things are untenable now that these documentaries are out there. So What the Health, Cowspiracy, certainly Forks Over Knives. Those have had a tremendous impact on, you know, just bringing people into an awareness of these issues, definitely.
For sure. And all those films expose the truth and they open people's eyes. And sometimes all it takes is the power of one film and someone will change your lives forever.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So I know that the people who are part of Capilano University, such as yourself, have been active for years now in promoting both veganism and sustainability throughout the school. Can you tell us about some of the past and ongoing initiatives that have taken place on your campus? And how can this innovation set a standard in promoting forward thinking and social justice advocacy that can be carried forth in other schools?
Oh, brilliant questions, Alison. Yes, so basically Capilano, you know, really markets itself as a staunch advocate for sustainability, and things can only really happen within such places when members of the community are sufficiently passionate about change in certain areas. Well, when I started working there in 2014, there was for me a noticeable vacuum regarding, for example, access to vegan food or even plant-based milks to accompany a cup of coffee. I approached the CapU Wellness Committee back in 2017 suggesting they launch a Veganuary event, which they were really keen to do, and they did it with aplomb. I mean, it was really a great event.
It's amazing.
So, very exciting. Roughly 85 students, somewhere in there, undertook the challenge, and we hosted highly successful launch and wrap-up events in which we had speakers, plant-based local companies offering promotional samples and competitions. And these events connected vegans for the first time among the staff and student body. And a vegan club was formed. And Brianna and McLean, who were the presidents of the Vegan Club, they worked tirelessly along with volunteers to create an amazing veg fest, which was held last September. Unfortunately, the Vegan Club may disband now that its most active members have graduated, unless I can encourage my students to take the reins, which
that
I'm hoping
always
to do.
Happens in university clubs. I've been there myself.
Right.
You
yes.
got to keep the young ones trained to take the leadership roles once the leaders go.
It is very transient, yes, in that respect.
Well, I understand that you have a charity line of t-shirt designed called Vegan Bliss, and you're using them to raise funds for EarthSave Canada. I don't don't know if you know, but I have quite a long history with EarthSave, being a volunteer for over a decade, and I was the office manager there also for years. So thanks for supporting EarthSave. Can you tell us more about this charity endeavor?
Yes, so basically I created these t-shirts, and it just seemed to make sense that the bulk of the proceeds go to a charity, because they are, in a sense, very partisan t-shirts that you might wear to a protest, you might wear to a demonstration, or you might just wear to sort of proclaim your advocacy. And so I have them as part of an exhibition at the Pacific Arts Market on it's at 1448 West Broadway, and a significant amount of the proceeds will go to EarthSave, and I'm hoping to create t-shirts here at CAP as well for this course, and hopefully for the vegan club. Yeah, that would be really nice to be the designer of the t-shirts here as well for the vegan club.
Yeah, and for those who don't know, EarthSave Canada has been around for many years, and their mission is to promote plant-based diets and educating about environmental issues, animal compassion, and your health. So fits hand in hand with what you're doing.
Yeah, it's definitely a charity that, you know, needs help, and is doing really good things.
Yeah, and then finally, can you just please tell us about the registration details for your course? You explained that it's part of a program called First Year Seminar, so who is eligible to take this course at this time?
Brilliant. Okay, so the intent of First Year Seminars course is for students with fewer than 30 credits. However, students could very well register having more than 30 credits. Okay. Due to the reciprocal transference of credits across higher education institutes, students don't actually have to come solely from CAP in order to take this course. The course needs 15 students minimum registered for it to go ahead. And how you register is basically to go to the website, the capilano.ca, and you hit the search bar in there, and you type in My CAP Schedule. And what will open up for you there is a list of FAQs, there's a tutorial, and there's even a PDF handy manual that you can open that will walk you through the steps of registering for a course, an academic course here at CAP.
Well, thank you so much, Nicholas, for coming on the show today to share with us the news of this new Veganism and Sustainability University course. And I thank you for being a higher education leader in planning innovatively to educate students on these issues on which every person should be educated. Once again, you can register for the Veganism and Sustainability course starting on July 9th by going to capilano.ca, hitting the search button and typing in My CAP Schedule. To connect with Nicholas personally, his email address is nicholasjennings@capilano.ca, and I'll also put that on our website too later today, animalvoices.org. And if need be, you can forward your queries to the committee that oversees these courses. And finally, if you're interested in checking out the Vegan Bliss charity t-shirts that Nicholas creates, you can go to Pacific Arts Market at 1448 West Broadway in Vancouver. Thanks for everything you are doing, Nicholas, to make the world a better place. And I just hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you so much, Allison. Likewise. Yeah, your program's amazing, and I tune into it every week. And thank you so much
for
finding the time to interview me. That's brilliant. Thank you so much.
Take care. Take care.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Listen to It Takes a Village, Thursdays, 4 p.m., a parenting show in the age of transparency. We reflect on current affairs, culture, activism, and pepper the hour with poignant songs that help explain the world. Join us every Thursday with your family on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
It takes a village. It takes a village to raise. It takes a village to raise a child.
For our feature interview today, we're excited to have local vegan advocate and food consultant Brigitte Gem on the show. Brigitte's mission is to support people who want to feed themselves and their families homemade plant-based meals cooked mostly from scratch. She feels that it's the right thing to do for health, for the planet, and for the animals, and is passionate about spreading the vegan love via her food consultation service called Vegan Family Kitchen. Brigitte is here today to speak about her vegan family kitchen and how embracing a lifestyle of smartly preparing and nourishing ourselves with plant-based whole foods can truly enhance our lives as well as the benefit of the planet. Hello, Brigitte, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's nice to see you in person. It's been a while. Thank you again for coming on to speak about your vegan family kitchen and your advice and philosophies on cooking great plant-based foods that nourish the whole family in both spirit and body. First, I would love to hear about your own vegan journey, which started not that long ago, about 6 years ago, I believe. And I know you are originally from Quebec, which was always has been meat eating capital to me. And you describe yourself as transforming from a meat loving carnivore to enthusiastic vegan. Can you please tell us about this life changing journey for you?
Yeah, you know, my story is a shocking example of the gap between knowing and doing, and the gap between knowing, feeling, doing. You know, people may think that rural Quebec is not a great place to end up a progressive, I guess. But there were actually in my education lots of Christian socialists that were still a big part of the educational system back then. And so advocacy for the poor and compassion for the suffering were always a pretty big part of my upbringing. And I was swayed in student activism early on. And it's too bad that there were no great courses like Nicholas Jennings' class back then. But I was doing social studies of technology, and it was a really critical field where we were examining environmental issues and even animal agriculture. And all around me at the same time, raising animals for food was just the normal thing to do, the normal way of life. My grandfather had a dairy farm, and my parents kept up the farming after. And, you know, when you see people that are confronted with, say, a cube of truth, you know, they see images from animal agriculture for the first time, sometimes they cry, and I had no idea, you know, they say things like that. Well, I don't have that excuse at all. I mean, from an early age, I remember hearing my dad talking about castrating the piglets and cutting their teeth and how it was for their own good. And I knew that baby cows were taken away from their moms. I totally knew that. And I also knew that slaughterhouses were hell, both for the animals and for the people working there. I had friends that were union reps working in a poultry processing plant. And so I knew all those things. But yet, what was normal to me was eating meat, dairy, and eggs. It was just the way food happened, and it never crossed my mind to do things any differently. But the good news is that there's a crack in everything, and there was one in my mind, I guess. And I have a friend who we have common roots in the same kind of activist groups in Quebec, and then she published this book that was studying the impacts of animal agriculture, and that's Elise Desaunis. She's now the director general.
She's the director
general of the SPCA in Montreal now, making the whole thing vegan. Anyway, amazing lady. But so I naturally trusted her, even though I was not interested in the topic to begin with. But I was like, well, that seems kind of interesting. And she mostly focused on the environmental aspects, but she also addressed how the dairy industry especially has been deceiving us from, you know, with false health claims, and animal rights obviously were her thing. And after reading the book, I really started cutting back significantly on animal products in general. But there was so much going on in my life. You know, I had my dream job finally at UBC at the time, and then I had a young child. I had to move to California for a year and commute back and forth. Things were just crazy. And it was, going vegan was not even on my radar, really, for a short while. But then my second child was born. And as I was nursing him late at night, as it always happened, and holding his little body against my chest, it occurred to me, like, how can I possibly take the babies away from cows just so that I can have cheese? right?
I wish more parents would think about that.
They just need a little bit of a nudge, I think, in connecting the dots. I've encountered many women that had that thought when they were breastfeeding, like, actually, I don't want to give, like, the milk of another mammal to my child. Like, what's that, right? And that was what tipped me on the other side, and it was the day when I decided, well, I got to stop waffling and just go vegan. And that was a little bit over 4 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. And you have a PhD, so you have all the research skills, and you educated yourself.
Exactly. But again, you know, the difference between knowing and doing something mm-hmm. is so vast. And there are lots of people that have a little bit of knowledge about all those things, but it takes sometimes a jolt to get their energy and their attention focused on the issue and transitioning into actually having actions that are consistent with their thinking.
Right. Well, I think the jolt is coming more and more. And as Jen was just talking about earlier, we're trying to inspire that as well by getting people to take the 22-day vegan challenge. In being the mom in a family with two young children and a husband, I can only imagine how stressful taking on the role to cook nourishing meals can be. It can even be if you're only cooking for yourself.
Totally.
And you're a self-described food lover, also a busy mother. Can you tell us about why you feel it's important as a parent to be ethically and environmentally conscious to feed your family good food?
When you think about it, food is the number one way in which we relate to the world around us. We literally are taking stuff on the outside, parts of the outside world, and putting it inside our bodies, and then it becomes our body. I mean, I'm not especially spiritual, but I'm in awe of this way in which we're all connected. And this act of eating is something that we do all the time, multiple times a day. You know, I certainly snack a lot, so at least, you know, 4, 5, 6 times a day we eat. That's over 100,000 times in the average lifetime. It's like water that's dripping and eroding a piece of rock, right? And one snack doesn't change your body and it doesn't change the world. You know, having a donut now and then is one thing, but when you think of the impact of that food over the course of your lifetime, and especially as I'm getting older, I'm starting to feel it, there's a great potential for impact there. And at this stage of my life, I have young children, I want to spend a lot of time with them. I'm not in a position where I feel comfortable engaging in the kind of activism that would get me in serious trouble. Mm-hmm. Definitely not.
And kids.
Yeah, with little children and, you know, things to do. Maybe later I'll go back to that. Mm-hmm. But right now I feel that the activism I can engage in is domestic activism, you know, home-based.
That's huge.
Totally, because I feed them multiple times a day, and at the very mm-hmm. least I can do that. And I have to do it. It's my responsibility. I can't really get around it. But as I was saying, there's also, I mean, aside from the environmental implications and animal rights, I'm also more sensitive to health implications now. I'm aging. My parents are aging, and I see what happens. My father had a ham sandwich every single day of his life, and he's not really dealing with the consequences. My mother is dealing with the consequences now that he's. Struggling with health, right. Let's put it that way. And I see my children, and I don't want that to happen to them. And it's not inevitable. I'm not thinking, you know, oh, I have bad genes. You know, all of my older relatives, they're all more or less falling apart, except the ones that were really taking good care of themselves. So I don't think it's like bad genes and, oh, it just runs in the family. No. And I can spare those health issues for my children and give them all the health and all the energy they need to realize their dreams.
So would you say that you feel it's a moral obligation to raise your children healthy and vegan, whereas lots of other parents don't do that?
I don't blame them. You know, I think it's beautiful that whole plant-based food just so happened to be at the intersection of self-care and other care, right? And that's great, but I have lots of compassion for parents who are not mm-hmm. there yet in their life. I think everybody has different resources. There's people like me, like who I was, who really have no excuses, but, you know, we need to keep on nudging them and making the information available. But there's also many parents who, both parents work, they struggle maybe financially. Yeah. Vancouver is a very cruel place to live in. Mm-hmm. And the food industry knows how to manipulate that. You know, after 2008, Hormel Foods started ramping up the production of Spam. And that is directly...
Can you even buy that in Vancouver?
Probably. I mean, not at Whole Foods, but I'm sure there's other places to buy it. And if you look at the numbers, it's directly connected to the increase of, pig farms and the increased pace of production on the line in the slaughterhouses. And those are also the places where they, you know, basically employ mostly undocumented migrants in the southern U.S., right? So the whole thing is a nightmare. But not every parent has the capacity to engage with that knowledge and do something about it, and clearly gets manipulated by advertising and food prices, frankly. But there's another thing that's also, I think we all have a different threshold for conflict. And
yes.
I speak to lots of moms, especially when they're blended families, where there's older children that are not so keen on doing what they're told at the dinner table and taking somebody else's food choices for themselves. And, you know, the thought of making dinner and then, you know, the nicest dinner you can possibly think of with fresh food and, you know, all home cooked, and you put it on the table and people lift their nose at it is very disheartening before you even start. And I have to admit that I keep a bag of Guardian, you know, fake chicken nuggets
in my freezer
for that reason. But that stuff is not cheap, right? Yeah. Compared to meat.
And you like cooking from scratch.
And I do, but there's only so much whining that I will put up with. You know, my four-year-old sometimes goes like, I don't want this dinner. Like, how are you going to say about that? But I can manage the conflict because my why is very strong. But not everybody is in that position. They're not all prepared for that. And I think that's why we need to keep on making the information available, make the health risk more clear as well. I think it's like, you know, you step in a car every day, you don't think about the fact that 45,000 people a year die in car accidents. Most people just take the car. Well, 100,000 people a year in Canada alone die of heart disease related causes. That's a lot of people. Like, that means that everybody knows somebody who's died or, you know, suffers from heart disease at any given point. But nobody thinks about that when they order, I don't know, a plate of ribs at the pub, right? But we need to make that risk more visible and less normal.
Yeah, it's saddening to me when some of my meat-eating friends post their... Someone posted their bacon and eggs for their dad's birthday. The dad's kind of getting older, and I just wanted to say that's a heart attack waiting to happen. You have to choose your words wisely and at the right time.
Exactly.
But I think that it has to be said. And, you know, this just... It's a very old school, archaic way of eating in my eyes, and I really hope that things change. But things are changing because people come to you. The people who come to you are the people who want to cook vegan. So I know you've devised a system of streamlined meal planning and a preparation approach that allows you to maintain a diverse diet of amazing plant-based meals and homemade snacks while cutting down the weeknight stress to a minimum. Can you tell us just a little bit about this system and how batch cooking fits in, and what would normally be the process that you follow that allows you to minimize time in the kitchen while maximizing flavor and nutrition?
You know, it's funny, I listen to you saying those things and I'm like, it makes me tired just to think about it, right? And the truth is that we have such high expectations. You know, we want the food to be nutritious because of all those, you know, what I just said about growing healthy kids. And we want the food to taste good. That's kind of obvious. We don't want to spend the day preparing it, so it has to be quick. We also get bored very easily. You mentioned, you know, diverse food, and I think I'm quite certain that 150 years ago, my great-great-grandmother was not feeding her children, you know, tacos on Tuesdays and pasta on Thursday and like some fancy dinner.
And you were saying that but when you were starting, you were making like 5 fancy dinners
per week.
And it was wearing on you.
And that's an expectation that we've come to build. I think it's part of the general globalization of modern life. You know, you go to the grocery store and there's all of these ingredients that are staples in so many different countries of the world. And now we put them on our table every week. And so there's a skill level and a knowledge level that is way beyond anything else. And on the one hand, I'm excited about it because I like all of that nutritious food. I want to optimize, you know, the food I eat, but it is a lot of work. And if eating like this is a priority for anyone, and for some people it isn't, right? They're happy with rice and beans and steamed broccoli most days of the week, and that's fine, but that would just not pass at my table, even.
It's not common. I think especially for someone who's just starting out, if they knew that that's what they liked, they wouldn't need you.
Exactly, right? And that's wonderful for them, and I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to eat. But most people have different expectations about food. And so if eating like this is a priority, then we need to make the time for it. There's no like magic vegan fairy that comes and cooks dinner. But when, right? And so let's just take one example. Let's say I want to have roasted vegetable paninis, which just thinking about it, I was like, that sounds good. But I get home at 6 o'clock with my kids. They're tired. They've done like gymnastics and who knows what. And we've done some, you know, homework after school. We get home, they're hungry. So they're screaming for snacks. If I want to have roasted vegetable paninis, I need to chop all of those vegetables. And then I need to roast them, which takes another 40 minutes. And then I need to prepare the paninis. And I don't have dinner until, you know, at best 7 o'clock. And that is just not feasible, sustainable in our life. And that's when the Guardian chicken nuggets might come out, right? And the only way to make that happen for me is to have the roasted vegetables done on the weekend, right? And that's where careful meal planning allows me, and it allows the people I work with, to decide what can be done on the weekend. I like to call it building blocks. So those parts of dinner that basically some other people might just purchase out of a bag or out of a box with a lot of ingredients, some of which don't really sound like food. So instead of taking those shortcuts, we spend a couple of hours on the weekend doing advanced cooking. And once the weeknight comes, well, I just need to reheat the roasted vegetables to make the paninis, and it's a lot easier. And same thing goes for example, homemade vegan mac and cheese without using processed cheese shreds. I mean, I'm glad those exist and that's wonderful as a convenience option, but you don't want to be eating that stuff every single day. But the only way to avoid it is to be prepared.
Well, I'm glad you use that approach to advise your clients on how to eat healthy. You're all about plant-based foods, right? So I'm just wondering if you could maybe describe the consultation process a bit that you would typically offer a client. And I know one of the resources you offer is a 10-day meal plan, for example. So if you could tell us about that and maybe what's on your current meal plan for this week, just to give our listeners an idea of what are these foods that you're teaching
sure.
people to eat.
Yeah, so most of my clients, and also because I have young children, as I was saying, I don't have a ton of time for individual clients. So most of my clients are subscribers to the meal plans. And this week, this is what they're having. They're having orange glazed bok choy stir fry and asparagus risotto. I love asparagus and I love risotto. And every time my husband eats risotto, he's like, isn't there cream in there? Like, how can it be so good without dairy? And I'm like, there should never be cream in risotto to begin with. But anyway, it's so good. Roasted vegetable pasta with hummus. I've discovered accidentally that hummus makes an amazing sauce.
Yes, I've discovered that too.
Isn't it great? Hummus is good for everything. And chickpea noodle soup, which I, if I remember correctly, is a slow cooker dish. So I make right. sure that we dust off that little appliance and use it. And on Friday, there's jackfruit tacos and nachos. And jackfruit is another good example of something that you can't really make quick. And you can buy those like packaged pre-seasoned jackfruit things, but I've heard they're awful, with all due respect to the people who make them, and perhaps some people like them, but that's the kind of thing that is a nice dish that you simmer on the weekend, and then you just, you know, slap the whole thing together on Friday night, and you have a wonderful dinner. So that's what's on the meal plan, for example, for this week, and you can notice that there's more like crunchy foods at the beginning of the week. You can't really see it, but there's also a balance where the food that comes at the end of the week tends to be more like soups or stews that have been made ahead, and the their flavors develop while they're waiting in the fridge, and then you just have to reheat them when you're really worn out at the end of the week.
Well, I also see that you advocate for zero waste living, it seems like, from watching your videos. And this is adding an extra layer to veganism itself, as veganism is in line with the ethos of doing the least harm, which is zero waste living itself. We've done a number of shows this past half year, actually, to learn more about the zero waste movement, and I'm always interested to learn more tips. Can you tell us what zero waste living looks like for you, and what are a few tips that you can offer to get our listeners to start actively working to send as little waste as possible to the landfill?
Yeah, I no longer feel shy about saying I'm vegan, but I'm a long way from saying I'm zero waste. Mm-hmm.
It's a spectrum. I'm on that pathway myself.
Yeah.
I'm not zero waste.
It's a journey.
I'm getting there.
And I think it's even harder. You know, of course, there's animal products and car tires and things like that, right? But even, you know, eating completely vegan is doable, but being completely zero waste in our society is really hard. And it would be easier if I didn't have kids, but I pick my battles. This being said, it's possible to be far along the spectrum in a place like Vancouver. Well, first of all, eating homemade food, and that's everything that I'm about, as opposed to eating out of a box, is the first thing that makes, you know, that's the low-hanging fruit, makes the biggest difference. From there, you know, having a meal plan and batch cooking and reducing food waste that comes from meal planning is a big difference. Buying fresh produce, if you live in the city, if you can buy fresh produce every 2 or 3 days instead of buying it, you know, in one big batch at the beginning of the week, it also reduces the odds of losing stuff partway. But, you know, there's some easy actions, like those silly produce plastic bags. Like, who needs that? It's okay if your apples kiss your lemons.
You know, in many cases, you don't even need bags. I will go to the store and just grab like an armful of fruit and put it in
my
reusable bag.
And most, I visit many people's kitchens, and sometimes I, like, every single little thing they picked up and they put it in a bag. It's just a habit that we can easily let go of. Bringing our own containers and filling, you know, reusable bags to fill from the bulk section is usually pretty easy. A lot of stores in Vancouver will tolerate it, and some even places where they don't, well, I do it anyway. I try to pick the cashier that's less annoying about it. And a couple times a year, that's a kind of a special trick of mine. I do what I call the vegan pantry challenge, and I encourage all of my readers to basically cook from whatever they have and to improvise cooking instead of, you know, pulling out a new recipe that says, oh, you need smoked paprika. Oh, I don't have smoked paprika. And then they go to the store and they buy smoked paprika. Well, too bad. You know, try to cook without it. Try to circumvent the problem.
And use your yet regular paprika.
Exactly. Wouldn't that occur to me?
I've been trying to do that this weekend, trying to make a chickpea curry last night with as many of the ingredients that I already had.
Totally. Yeah. And knowing what you have, I think having good control over your inventory. So once a year, I pull everything out. I dust off the shelves and I try to cook with those rare spices and condiments that maybe I bought and I'm not using. So those are just easy, you know, low-hanging fruits that anybody can do. You don't need to be perfect. You don't need to always be looking for produce without stickers on it. I mean, if you manage to do that, that's wonderful. But there are very impactful gestures you can do even with basic efforts.
So we only have 1 minute left, but I just wanted to get to one more question that I know you wanted to talk about. Now, in your vegan food consultations, would you say that you're usually consulting with the mothers and wives of the families as opposed to fathers and husbands? Is that how it normally goes?
Totally, yes.
Okay, so you know that from your work. So I'm wondering what, if you can describe what that is like. I imagine you bear witness to perhaps gender dynamics that are at play when it's the female head of the family who's trying to bring veganism and good health into the home, and perhaps there is opposition from the male side. I know that I have experienced that myself, and it can be really stressful. So, big question. Do you have a quick answer?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned domestic activism earlier. For a lot of women that have a spouse and children that may not be that welcoming of plant-based diets, it's really what it feels like. There are small victories, but there's also a lot of conflict, and all of it can be emotionally draining. You know, the personal is political. It also, you know, stands for food. So I just want to, you know, tip my hat to the women by and large, they're driving that growth of the plant-based economy. Most of them are not vegan, right? But again, they're very aware of those environmental and ethical implications of the food that they serve their families, and of course of the health thing. And they need to get extra courage to face the opposition that they encounter at the home front at the time when they are most tired, usually. And those people are making a huge difference, and I really want to recognize them and to try to support them however I can.
Well, you can do that because you have your vegan family kitchen. Thank you so much, Bridget, for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Allison.
To speak with us about your vegan family kitchen, which is a vegan food consultation service, and how you can be inspired and empowered by making change in the world in your duty for cooking whole plant foods for yourself and your family in an efficient, fun, and sustainable manner. If you've been inspired by Bridget's great info and would like to learn more about her work or to book a free consultation, you can visit her website at veganfamilykitchen.com or find her on Facebook at Vegan Family Kitchen. Thanks, and I hope you have a good cooking weekend this weekend.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Animal Voices Radio on CFRO Co-op 100.5 FM in Vancouver, Canada. We'd love to connect with you online at animalvoices.org, where you can listen to past shows, or on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And just a reminder to sign up for our 22-day vegan challenge if you aren't vegan yet. It begins June the 1st, and the support group is on our Facebook page now. Tune in next week at noon for an interview with Iza Leshko, who takes portraits of aging animals as a tribute to creatures too often dismissed as mere livestock. Stay tuned next for Radio Eco Shock, and remember to be kind to the animals. We leave you today with the song Change Change by Thistle, an appropriate theme for all of the interviews featured on today's show. Thanks for listening.
Think you can